I'm going to say a few things in general before reading out. Lotus Sutta is interesting because it talks about how to carry on when perhaps the we don't see the Buddha, we don't see Shakyamuni. This was a big problem, of course, even for many of the arhats and enlightened sangha at Shakyamuni's time. How will they carry on without his presence? He said the Dharma will look to the Dharma, of course. but still, we need direction. And after the Buddha's parinirvana, of course, different interpretations sprang up. And of course, even when the Buddha went on retreat or was gone for a while, people had different opinions. So the Lotus Sutra tries to answer like what all these different opinions that arose, how do we determine what's the real true Dharma or different styles? But on a more fundamental level, what to do when the Buddha is not present. Now on an inner level, it's pointing to what we do in our practice when we're not, I should say, this is kind of American style, but we're not feeling our Buddha nature, okay? how do you practice when you really don't feel your intelligence and wakefulness and warmth and compassion is present? Maybe there's some of you in the room where it always feels present, and you never have to like think, well, where did that go? But for the majority of people, we have this experience that sometimes it feels far away, or our wisdom and kindness and love doesn't feel very present. So how then should we practice? This is one of the key points that the Lotus Sutra looks at. Like, when you're not feeling like it, when you're not feeling like centered, calm, altogether, kind or mindful or whatever, how to practice. The Lotus Sutra is very adamant about how we do that. Of course, some people have been regularly attending my Lotus Sutra talk, so that should be a no-brainer, how we practice, even when we don't feel like it. But we'll do some reading to revive that if people have forgotten, or for newcomers who haven't heard that before. But this is a key point, not about just the sutra, but our own daily practice. When we're not feeling it, then what shall we do? I mean, do we try to call it up? Do we run back to our cushion? What do we do? This is akin to the question that I like to ask people publicly here, but also in darshan and interview, what keeps you going? I'm always interested in that, So there are people here that have been around for a long time, and had moments of disappointment or conflict at home or with Sangha members, or of course it's always within ourselves. So you should ask yourself, and I'm always interested, well, what keeps you going? What keeps you coming back? So answering that question is very akin to, how do we practice when we don't feel like it? Or we just don't feel that very calm or centered like that. Maybe we feel like feeling calm or centered, but we don't feel calm and centered. I think this is a really big issue, don't you? Okay. So, so many of the contemporary teachers in America, and of course, higher teachings such as, Mahamudra and Dzogchen talk about, innate presence and indestructible goodness and things like that. But the truth is, a lot of times we just don't feel that connected, and we don't feel like practicing anything. And what do we do then? How do we get through those times? Do we give up? Do we act out? Do we run to the cushion? What do we do? If you think about it, there's not that many, like, from my side, I don't know, I read a lot. Not that I have to read, I just want to keep up on what, you know, people are saying, right? And other people are reading. So, like, people know, if they come to Darshan, they said, I'm reading this, and I go, well, who told you to read that? Nobody, but I found it on Amazon. I might pick it up, too, and read it, right? Just so, like, what are you reading? But very few practices actually talk about how to practice when we're not in a practice mode, right? We don't like anybody. We don't like ourselves. We don't feel connected with Dharma. We think the whole thing is stupid, bad, and wrong, and we're stupid, bad, and wrong, and the other people are stupid, bad, and wrong. So what do we do? In Vajrayana, we have a practice called calling the Lama from afar, which is when we're feeling utterly bereft and you know, it's kind of like biblical, a voice crying in the wilderness, right? But in the Lotus Sutra, that there, the Mahayana style is emphasized. So this is really essential. If one of my detector questions is, you know, what, how do you practice when you don't feel like it? You know, when you feel the whole thing is falling down and the practice doesn't work, you've tried to be nice to everybody, and you've tried to do a good job, and you've helped out the Dharma Center, no one appreciates it, and you know, on top of that, they heap coals in your head. You know, what keeps you going? So this is one of the most exciting things about the Lotus Sutra, is it talks about how we deal with obstacles and deal with people that also outside ourselves that are obstacles, right? So much of the contemporary literature we read, like, well, if we just stay mindful, it will be easy, right? You know, it's not easy. It makes it tougher, actually. Because when you turn the lights on, you see the dust, you see how things are not organized, right? So, Vajrayana and the Lotus Sutra, which is a very Vajrayana text, indestructible vehicle kind of text, really address how we work with conflict, how we work with discouragement, you know, how we work with the sense of loss when we don't have any, you know, people to depend on, right? Am I making sense? Yeah. So I'm going to read a little bit from chapter 13 from, is it working? A little funny. No, it's like blasting. Is it blasting now? It's better. Okay, good. Yeah, okay. Buddha Dharma is still an oral translation, oral tradition. So it's nice to just have it read out and say, well, I heard the Lotus Sutra, you know, June 25th, Sacramento. At that time, the Bodhisattva Medicine King, the Great One, and the Bodhisattva Great Delight in Preaching, the Great One, with their following of 20,000 Bodhisattvas, all in the presence of the Buddha, made a vow saying, we beg you, world-honored one, do not worry. After the extinction of the Buddha, we will honor and embrace, read and recite, and teach the sutra. In the evil age to come, living beings will have fewer and fewer good roots, while their utter arrogance will increase. Their desire for profitable offerings will grow, increasing their roots that are not good, taking them further from liberation. Though it may be difficult to teach and transform them, we will have the strength of great patience, and we will read and recite this sutra, embrace, teach, and copy it, and make all kinds of offering to it without sparing our bodies or lives. Then the 500 arhats in the assembly who had been assured of becoming Buddhas said to the Buddha, World Honored One, we also vow to teach this sutra everywhere in different lands. There were also 8,000 people, both in training and trained, who had already been assured. Rising from their seats and putting their palms together facing the Buddha, they made a vow saying, World Honored One, we also will teach this sutra everywhere throughout other lands. Why? Because in this world people are corrupt and evil, full of utter arrogance, of shallow virtues, angry, fawning, devious, and insincere. Then the sister of the Buddha's mother, the nun Mahaprajapati, with 6,000 nuns in training and trained, rose from their seats and putting their palms together in complete attention, gazed up at the face of the Honored One without taking their eyes away even for a moment. The World Honored One said this to Gautami, Why do you gaze at the Tathagata in such a troubled way? Are you wondering why I have not mentioned your name to assure you of supreme awakening? Gautami, I've already announced that all Shravakas generally are assured. Now, if you want to have your assurance, I will tell you that in future lives, in the midst of the teachings of 68,000 millions of Buddhas, you will become a great Dharma teacher, and these 6,000 nuns in training and trained will all become Dharma teachers. Thus, you will gradually fulfill the Bodhisattva way and become a Buddha named seen with joy by all the living Tathagata, one worthy of offerings, truly awakened, fully clear in conduct, well gone, understanding the world, unexcelled leader, trainer of men, teacher of heavenly beings and people, Buddha, World Honored One. Gautami, this seen with joy by all the living Buddha will in turn assure 6,000 Bodhisattvas of supreme awakening. Then the mother of Rahula, the nun Yashodhara, thought, In his assurances, the World Honored One has left only my name unmentioned. The Buddha said this to Yashodhara, In future lives, in the midst of the Dharma of hundreds of thousands of billions of Buddhas, by doing Bodhisattva practice, you will become a great Dharma teacher, gradually fulfilling the Buddha way, and in a good land, become a Buddha named having 10 million shining characteristics, Tathagata, one worthy of offerings, truly awakened, fully clear in conduct, well gone, understanding the world, unexcelled leader, trainer of men, teacher of heavenly beings and people, Buddha, World Honored One. The lifetime of that Buddha will last innumerable, countless eons. Then the nuns Mahaprajapati and Yashodhara, together with all their following, were full of joy, having gained something they'd never had before. In the presence of the Buddha, they immediately spoke in verse. World honored, leader and teacher, comforter of human and heavenly beings, hearing your assurance was just what we needed. We are at peace. After reciting this verse, the nuns said to the Buddha, World honored one, we too are able to proclaim the sutra everywhere throughout the lands and the regions. Then the World Honored One looked at the 80 trillion myriads of Bodhisattva great ones. All these Bodhisattvas were at the stage of never backsliding, had turned the never retreating Dharma wheel, and mastered incantations. They got up from their seats, went before the Buddha, and putting their palms together in complete devotion, thought to themselves, If the World Honored One orders us to embrace and teach this sutra, we will proclaim this Dharma everywhere as the Buddha has taught it. And then they thought, The Buddha is now silent and gives us no orders. What should we do? Respectfully obeying the Buddha's will and themselves wanting to fulfill their original vows, these Bodhisattvas raised a lion's roar and vowed before the Buddha, saying, World Honored One, after the extinction of the Tathagata, we will travel throughout the worlds in all directions to lead all living beings to copy this sutra, receive and embrace it, read and recite it, explain its meaning, practice it as to their Dharma, and keep it in mind correctly. All this will be done through the Buddha's majestic power. Please, World Honored One, though in another region, see us and protect us from afar. Then the Bodhisattvas all raised their voices together and spoke in verse, Please do not worry. After the Buddha's extinction in a frightful and evil age, we will teach everywhere. Though many ignorant people will curse and abuse us or attack us with swords and sticks, we will endure it all. So it goes on in verse, and at the end of the verse, we are emissaries of the World Honored One. Facing multitudes without fear, we will teach the Dharma well. May the Buddha live in peace and comfort. In the presence of the World Honored One, all the Buddhas who have come from all directions, we make this vow. The Buddha knows what is in our heart. that's big. What's going on here? That's really important, which sounds sometimes a little bit difficult for new American Buddhists, is this power of the vow. In the Mahayana tradition, particularly in Mahayana Vajrayana tradition, the vows we make are what carry us through. For example, in the Sukhavati sutras that describe the Pure Land of Joy and the Amitabha Buddha who rules or enlightens there. In the past, Amitabha was a bodhisattva but made the vows, 14, I think it's 14 vows, that the bodhisattva would do all these things, and then they happened and he became Amitabha Buddha. And those who make a vow to practice and to be born in the Sukhavati will, based on Amitabha's vow, the power of the vow, will be born there. This is the basis of Jodo Shinshu, Pure Land Buddhism, which has been huge in China and Japan. Anybody ever been to a Jodo Shinshu temple? Anybody been to the Riverside Church? Yeah. So, because of Amitabha's vows as Bodhisattva, Amitabha now is a Buddha and has the Pure Land Sukhavati. And then as a result of our vows and relying upon Amitabha's vows, we too can go and be reborn in Sukhavati if we want. It sounds magical, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound so far from kind of regular insight meditation or mindfulness? Okay. It isn't really, it's just using the incredible power of our will and our emotions. Sometimes people think in meditation we should just be completely passive. We should just kind of like whatever happens, okay. That's true to a certain extent, but we're willing to have whatever happens. See, willing. We're making a vow, like I'm going to sit here no matter what happens. Our ability to sit for a whole session, whether it's 6 minutes or 6 hours, is based upon our intention, our will, our willingness. People that make the intention will get there. People don't make the intention won't get there. So that's why in our tradition we do the refuge vows, we do bodhisattva vows, we do tantric vows, not as a way of joining a club, but as a way of guaranteeing the momentum to carry through the dry spells in our practice. It's incredibly powerful. Sometimes it doesn't mean a lot when we're doing, you know, vows, you know, in ceremonies we don't understand. But my experience having been married and marrying people as Lama is that actually people like to put energy into their vows, don't they? Particularly now, you know, like people like to plan a wedding and, you know, food and napkins and flowers. But most people these days like to put a lot of energy into their vows. Isn't that your experience too? Almost nobody I've met just says, well, I'm just going to, you know, go with the Book of Common Prayer, or I'm just going to, you know. Actually, in Buddhist countries, there is no formal marriage ceremony. So if you want to get married Dharma-wise or get married here, you're going to have to make up some of your own vows, you know. You know, a lot of times people just finish projects, stay together in relationships because they promised they'd do it, right? In the old days, it used to be just like, well, I give my word, right? That's a vow. I said I'd do it. I gave my word. So these kind of vows are incredibly powerful if you really understand the nature of giving your word, making the intention, making the vow. I vowed on my teacher's deathbed that I would do this. I'll never forget it. I'm not trying to say I'm better than anybody else, but I actually did. That's powerful. Your teacher's dying and you say, you're going to do this thing, right? Am I going to give that up? I'm not giving that up. I might have to go this way and then this way. It's like doing Dharma in Sacramento. It's like you're in a small sailboat and you have to sail the other side of the ocean or the lake, but the wind's right in. You know, anybody with a small sailboat, you know, you have to tack this way and then tack that way. So it's like that, right? So are there vows that we've made to someone, you know, a parent, a friend, a child, that there would be no way you would ever break? Does any, you know, must be thinking about that, something you would never, ever break. You'd rather, like, you'd rather be dead. Would you think of that, you know, or like, I'd rather get sick or lose my hand or something, you know? These are serious. I bet everyone has a certain vow like that, that there's no way you would go back on it. If we don't have that kind of determination in anything, whether it's Dharma or relationships or business or the planet or ourselves, we're probably really drifting, right? We're probably also subject to a lot of addiction. There's, you know, we're just going to go with whatever, you know, is the strongest impulse at the time, right? We have no vow. We have no intention. We have no will. But the strongest the vow is, the stronger the intention and the will toward a virtuous object, of course, toward a good direction, it's impossible to stop. At least you won't violate it. Because everybody think of something they just wouldn't, you know, they must complete and they wouldn't leave uncompleted. That's what we're talking about in the Lotus Sutra. Of course, we're saying the sutra, but the sutra stands itself for Buddha activity, for enlightened activity, right? So, of course, they're the words, but when we're saying the sutra, to expound it, to share it, to talk about it, we're talking about the one vehicle of complete awakening of the Buddha nature, like that. So this kind of determination, this kind of energy is really unstoppable. So we can maintain the vow, we can maintain the energy of intention even when we have high level resistance and don't feel like it. And that's the interesting part, right? We can follow through because we've made this promise to ourselves, we've made a vow, we've, you know, created that kind of karma, right? So we're using the positive aspect of karma to continue practice. Maybe we need a little discussion, right? Then we'll take a short break and meditate. Maybe I'm totally explained everything, but I'm open to, like, this is a big deal, because sometimes we just think, oh, I'll just be present and then everything will work out, right? Sometimes, you know, it's presented that way. But try just being present without a sense of, you know, making a vow to follow something through. Because we can be just as present, you know, lying on the couch as doing the dishes, right? So that's, we can just be as present sitting at home. So what made, you know, people that have continually supported their practice, supported coming here to temple in spite of obstacles, you know, what kind of vow have you made to yourself and to me and to others or the three jewels or other people that you're going to follow through? Maybe we can have some discussion. I'm always interested when people come up with discussions or debates, of course. Hi.
Is it necessarily an expressed, verbalized, you know, I could write it in a paragraph thing? Or is it more, or could it be more of just a I don't want to say amorphous intention, but not necessarily one that is really easy to articulate?
It probably starts out as amorphous, you know, because we're just going to, little embryo Buddhas, right? We're going to just mushy little embryos, you know. It becomes more powerful as we express it and share it and make the lion's roar. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we just have to testify to the truth and we have to actually say it. So that's why we have like a public or Sangha like refuge, and we'll do Bodhisattva vows at some point and Tantric vows. Of course, it's taking place in our heart, hopefully, first. It's not like, you know, the ceremony itself makes it, just like going to initiation or empowerment ceremony means you've gone to the initiation or empowerment ceremony, but the initiation or empowerment is something that may not take place or take place later or is already taken place, right? But the more we can bring it out and refine it and share it, just like the more, particularly in Lotus Sutra, big emphasis on sharing, the more we can testify to it and sharing, it increases the power. Traditionally, you would say you're gaining more merit, but that kind of sounds like you're kind of just getting more, you know, something out of it. But the more we share, the stronger it becomes. But it is generally going to start out kind of...
Well, and if you make it public, if you do make a proclamation of some sort and you do make it public, then like going back on it or ignoring it is really difficult.
It's difficult to deny that, you know, like when we do ceremonies where we're out there, at least we can't say it didn't happen. You know, we can, well, I did get married, or I did, you know, I did do refuge, and everyone's, well, we were there, and this is the date, and this is what happened. So we can say later, maybe I regretted it, but we did it. So, yeah.
Now we got green. That means we can talk. Thank you, Lamala, for sharing that sutra with us. And it really kind of talks together with your talk about, and I think tying the sutra together with what he's trying to say here is that once he's gone in the latter day of the Buddha, it's going to take perseverance. Mm-hmm. And that there's going to be sticks and stones that are going to come out when you're talking about the Dharma and sharing it. And as we go on in time, people are going to get farther and farther away from the path of liberation. And by doing so, it's going to make it more difficult to share the Dharma. So you have to persevere, right? In one way or another, that's manifesting bodhicitta. And again, the same thing which you were talking about earlier, what happens when you don't have that bodhicitta within you to spark the flame for the Buddha Dharma to want to practice. And again, it's about persevering. And what resonated earlier, and again, what keeps me going is thinking about the suffering of the 2,000 kids right now that are away from their parents, and how we can help relieve that suffering of these sentient beings, right? Because they didn't do anything to deserve the suffering. That's going to spark some bodhicitta in me, or at least something. I'm going to feel something in my mind or in my body, right? Whether it's anger or an emotion that's going to take twice as much to generate some positive action and behavior out of that, rather than just going angry about it, right? So... That's what I have to do for my practice. Yes. So thank you again for being here and sharing with us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. The Lotus Sutra is very, you know, it's kind of sharp and cutting sometimes about there'll be people within the Sangha who are going to be difficult and you'll be criticized. This has to do with inner criticisms too, right? You know, if you're practicing correctly... You're stirring up some dust. If you're practicing correctly, you're turning on the light and you're seeing the dust, right? So first we turn on the light, we see the dust, but then when we start sweeping, we also stir a little bit up. Isn't that so? So the Lotus Sutra is very honest about saying, yeah, there will be obstacles. But that's the point. We want to bring up the obstacles and bring them to light and testify to our practice. So I'd like to add to that, there maybe 2,000 kids that we're talking about. It's actually probably more, of course, you know. Yeah. You know, years ago, of course, there were like orphans from Bosnia and, you know, just incredible things. So, yeah, unbelievable. Yeah. So, as Dharma people, Mahayanists, we don't become discouraged as far as giving up. We can be angry and discouraged in a relative way. Of course, you know, there's no reason to say, whoopee, let's do Dharma here. You know, it's very difficult. But the power of the bodhicitta is one way we talk about the vow, the bodhisattva vow of developing ourselves to be free and to free others. But the power of the vow is important. So, but I always think, some people think it's kind of corny, you know, I don't know why. When we use the term vow, does anybody think that's like, they don't like the word vow? Some people don't like vows. Everyone here likes vows? Okay, well, that's right. Good. All right. So, when we do a bodhisattva vow ceremony, then I'll expect to see the majority of the people here, right? Lotus Sutra is not one of the major sutras in Himalayan Buddhism. I'm not quite sure why. It's studied and practiced. It became most popular in China and then later Japan. I think part of the popularity in China, it was that China was a highly hierarchical society. Not that Tibet wasn't, but Tibet was more kind of just cowboy. I mean, not as hierarchical. But when Dharma came to China, there was very strong, you know, emperor and peasants and everything. And the Lotus Sutra really just said, no, everybody is accepting Buddha Dharma. And also very strong, you know, reaching out to nuns, females, practitioners, which was quite bold and probably still is quite bold. So the Lotus Sutra in China and also in Japan became a very strong center sutra teaching for progressive political and Dharma movements in China and in Japan too. Anybody else like talking about the Lotus Sutra? Look it up, yeah. You know, it's true. The history of the Lotus Sutra, not just as a sutra and the teachings, but the how the sutra itself became a catalyst to do practice, in, particularly in China and Japan. We do need some justification sometimes, or inspiration to do sometimes political action, and to stand up and say that's not right, don't we? So the Lotus Sutra says, you know, we should speak truth to power. You heard the lion's roar in this chapter, right? Term the lion's roar. So there's the term the lion's roar in the Pali Sutras, term the lion's roar in Vajrayana, and here it is right in the Lotus Sutra. Should we stretch for a few minutes and then any other comments, questions, or complaints? There's some people I haven't met or said hi to, so I'll just sit here if you want to come up and say hi. That would be great. So Shall we come back exactly at 8 o'clock? Okay. Om Aham. Very good. Stand up, stretch, walk around, talk. That's all. There are different styles of meditation. In our tradition, we talk about two main aspects. One is stabilizing meditation, where we're learning to concentrate and calm and focus and clear the mind. The other one is sometimes called insight or analytic. In Tibetan, it would be like Latong, like superior seeing. Sometimes that's direct intuition. Sometimes it's relying on prajna, sharab, or jhana, or yeshe, something like that. But also, we do analytic meditations where we're thinking about, we're like searching for the nature of mind. But we also do narrative meditations. Narrative meditations are where we take a phrase or a truth and we investigate it and turn it over. We dwell and contemplate on it. So in training, we might just take the four immeasurables, we take the four noble truths, we take any Dharma text and we let it sink in deeply. It might be anything from first noble truth to Mahamudra, but in our tradition, we spend time with narrative meditations, just like we do mantras. In some forms of American Buddhism, it's just restricted to, mindfulness styles, but we use everything in our tradition because we need it. So a narrative style would be, thinking about the Lotus Sutra, thinking about what is our vows, what inspires our vows, what keeps it going is an important part of the practice. It's really funny, when I do this practice myself, and I'm a little bit distracted, then it feels hard, and I just want to do like shamatha or stabilizing meditation. I just want to concentrate on my breath, right? But then sometimes when I go, okay, I'm just going to do shamatha, stabilizing in breath, then I want to do a narrative meditation. What is that anyway? No matter what, it's like, I want to do the opposite, So one of the teachers at Naropa, Dr. Wegela, she said, try doing a mindless meditation, like not paying attention to everything. And then, whenever you start paying attention to something, distract yourself as a practice, and you find out, God, that's hard. I just want to be mindful. It's really funny. We're such oppositional creatures. You start doing thinking about the vows and how you connect with people and how you follow through and what keeps you going, and then you get a little tired, then do, just some breath meditation. Or do mantra work. And then when that comes a little tiresome, then you can go back to the narrative, right? Like that. So this isn't skipping around. This is skillful means, right? Skipping around is just being impulsive, and just whatever. Skillful means is going, I'm gonna do this meditation, which may be difficult. And if it's difficult and I need to switch, a little bit to rest or, switch functions, then I can do something else. That's not cheating. So many times on long retreats, people try doing shamatha practice, and then they're getting stale, and It doesn't mean you just keep grinding away at things. Sometimes it's necessary to shift focus. I don't know if they went into this on the retreat you did. Did they talk about that, Dana? Maybe what to do when you're exhausted a little bit? They did, yeah. Yeah, you were in deep. You were in deep samadhi, you know, like that. Okay. But that's reasonable. When if you're going on a long hike, you know, particularly up a mountain, then, you know, it's important to have a rest stop and to pull over, right? So we're very conscious of pacing ourselves. It's difficult to keep your mind on one thing, isn't it? So we build up to it. So if you think, oh my God, I'm just thinking about the vow for 1 minute or the bodhicitta for 1 minute, now I'm tired, then go to breath for a while, but then come back. Be persistent, right? Oh, I'm going to take a little break, but I'll be back. And then we gradually build up our strength. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's not like, you know, oh, I can't pay attention. I'm just going to, you know, think about, you know, what I'm going to do when I'm going to get home. You know, you can just rest on the breath. When you're ready, come back to, you know, doing a narrative meditation. Yeah, generally, don't do that here. Yeah, but at home, yeah. I mean, all the meditation texts talk about, you know, splash water on your face. You know, walk around. And some retreats I've done, you know, I don't like to do it anymore because now I'm getting old, but, you know, stand on the edge of something or meditate on the edge of a cliff. It's amazing how then that keeps you awake, you know? Like that, you know? One time, you know, I used to have really long hair, and yogis sometime would, then you'd tie a rope and throw it around your beam, the beam. And that I did that. So these are kind of things that keep you going. It doesn't keep you in good posture, but if you slouch off, you find out real quick. So, you know, it's not that the rope is keeping you, you know, upright. It's just when you start doing this, you'll get it. Has anybody ever heard of that before? Yeah, there's tons of things like that. Seriously, you know, when you're on long retreat, there's meditation belts, gomchen, you know. So I have one of those, you know, and you wrap it around yourself. And sometimes at a retreat, you just sit in a box, you know, so that one of my favorite ones is that, you know, you're just wrapping and you have a beam and you're throwing it over. But it doesn't keep you upright. That's the important thing, like that. Or there's the meditation kind of resting things, you know. So you have this kind of stick like this. And, it, you know, you put your chin on there like that, you know. And some great yogis, they'd have like a little knife right there. Now I'm telling tales. You're thinking this is, I'm coming to crazy Dharma Center, you know. But that's just skillful means. So just, you know, work with your mind. Okay. That bell has a nice sound, doesn't it? It's not one of the more expensive bells. You know, sometimes people try to get the most expensive Dharma objects possible. Don't need to. Before we do prayers, we have some announcements, right? Do you want to say something about the sale and the Tara Garden, Sharon?
Oh, so bring your donations on Thursday, 11 o'clock to 1, and is it 4 to 7? Something like that. Yeah. So we'll be here to unload.
There might not be. Well, first of all, yeah, the sale is like Friday and Saturday morning, right? And it's a busy weekend. Then right after that, we're doing, I'm doing with Venerable Tenzin Choki the workshop called Compassion Boundaries. And, you know, I'm thinking about boundaries, and permeable boundaries are where, like, it starts at one, but maybe, you know, maybe some people will still be finishing up at the sale, but want to come, so it's okay to come late. Janice and I were talking about France over the break, and the French are, you can ask them anything, but you need to say bonjour first, okay? Because, you know, it's establishing a relationship. Your greeting, or bonsoir, or bon nuit, you know. So, like here, whenever you know, it's okay if people come late, but in a traditional temple, you'd come and least you do kind of a bow from the waist and then sit down, or you could even do a prostration and then take your seat. You see, so it isn't that you come in late and just kind of go, "Oh, I'm here," you know. So, it's all about that, right? So, if we remember, say bonjour. Then at least for doing, you know, it's okay to drop in, right? That's important because we're establishing a relationship with the Gompa, with the temple. We're greeting it and greeting each other. And then we're, you know, that happened a lot at Buddhist time. You read all the sutras, they're saying this monk, this nun, this lay person, the Buddha was giving a talk and the person came up and, you know, greeted, didn't gusho. And that's what it's all about, right? So we'll send out another email. And then Sunday, my birthday party, right? So it's a lot. So everyone's invited to that, right? Everyone's invited to the feast. Yeah. What else should we announce? That's a lot. Yeah, lots going on this weekend. So might be a little bit warm. But we'll do it, right, Peter? Okay, thank you. All right, let's do closing prayers. No, just show up. Yeah, just show up. Yeah, that's good. Just show up. These are the actions.